camera for Donnie.
Go for Donnie.
Sound for Donnie.
Go for Donnie.
Makeup for Donnie.
Go for Donnie.
We're both for Donnie.
Go for Donnie.
Group department for Donnie.
Go for Donnie.
Wardrobe for Donnie.
Go for Donnie.
Tim for Donnie. Go for Donnie.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have Tim Healy on the show today. Tim, thanks for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, great to see you, Donnie.
Oh, my gosh. Before we get into how I know Tim, everybody stay tuned after the show for Switch to Channel 2, where we'll get to ask our guest Tim some more questions, get to know him a little bit better, what he's doing, and what's coming up next with Tim. So, Tim, just to bring it back around how Tim and I know each other, I worked on a show, one of Tim's shows. That was a lot of fun, and Tim came out to set with us, and we had a great time and got on and heard some of his stories out there on set, and I wanted to get him on the show to tell some other crazy stories, because I mean, you're like a vault up there, man. I mean, just some crazy stories, and then when we get to Switch to Channel 2, I get some other things I want to ask you about, like Beyond Skinwalker Ranch and, you know, some of that good shit.
For sure. Yeah, look, I knew you and I were going to hit it off the second I walked in the PO, and I saw a gigantic coffee rig. And I said, okay, this guy's, I'd never met you. And I was like, first impressions is everything. And I said, this guy likes to drink good coffee. So we immediately hit it off, Donnie. So thank you so much for bringing the beans.
You're welcome, man.
Expedition,
I mean,
Bigfoot.
You got to keep us and everyone fueled, especially for a show like that, you know, the hours that we kept, and such a fun show. And I'm telling you, it was one of the best crews that I worked with still to date. And, you know, from the top down, Yeah. So much fun.
It was a lot of fun. So, yeah, I mean, you know, for me, you know, you never want to show your age, but I got my start in the Wild West of MTV back in the mid 90s. So
out of New York.
Yeah. So I was living on Long Island. I was a recent college graduate. I had spent the summer as a driver at the first MTV beach house. So MTV did not have car service at the time. So they hired this college kid, me, paid me $75 a day to drive a 15-passenger van. And I would drive into Manhattan and I would pick up all the on-air talent, guests, celebrities, VJs, and crew, and I would drive them from Manhattan to out to the Hamptons where the beach house was. And it was like the greatest summer job ever. Donnie, can you hear my dogs?
Yeah, that's right. It's dogs.
All right. I'm so sorry. So yeah, so I was at I got my start driving that van back in 1994. Very long time. And at the time MTV was it really was kind of the epitome of youth culture. You know, it's pre-internet. And there was nobody, like, the people that were in charge were, like, not corporate. And they were not suits. And it was, like, honestly, the lunatics running the asylum. And it was a lot of fun. And we got away with a lot of stuff that we would never get away with today.
Yeah, I know.
And I remember a crazy story. We did a program called MTV's Ultimate Winter Vacation. So I got a phone call and they said, what are you doing in 2 weeks? And I, nothing. How do you feel about going to Hawaii for 3 weeks and then Aspen, Colorado for 3 weeks? And it was in the wintertime. Yeah. So, and the idea was you go to a summer vacation like Hawaii and then you go to a winter vacation. We were going to shoot on the mountain in Aspen. So I said, geez. I'm in.
Yeah.
So we go all the way out to Aspen, and all my friends, you know, we're all living in this hotel, and they book Oasis to play a concert at the at the Winter Lodge that we're at. And the night before we're supposed to shoot with Oasis, we were having a party in the hotel. So my bosses had this big suite, and we're all in there, and we're all having this party. There's a knock at the door. And we opened the door, and literally Oasis is standing there. We had no idea that they were coming. Nobody told us. And it was around the holidays, and it was the entire band standing there. No management, just the four of them, and holding a poinsettia.
That's and they crazy. Were like, what?
May we come in? And we said, sure, come on in. So, you know, I'm 20. This is 1995. So I'm like 22 at the time. We're all in our 20s. And now all of a sudden, like Oasis, like one of the biggest bands in the world is at our party, right? And they're very nice. They're like super cordial, and we're having some drinks, and they had a reputation for being kind of rough and tumble, and you know, brawlers, yeah. And you know, we couldn't understand shit because of the accent. So we just kind of like, so we're all kind of having a great time, and then as the night progressed, they went from being really nice and cordial to kind of having a little bit of an edge, you know, going to the bathroom every 15 minutes and coming back, right? And they didn't like the music we were playing. So we had like a boombox set up, and my friends were just kind of putting CDs in. It was just a bunch of guys hanging out. And we were listening to the Beastie Boys. So we had the Paul's Boutique record playing. Oh. And they hated the Beastie Boys. Oh. So we would hit play on the CD, and then 20 seconds later, Liam would walk over, would eject the CD, and would put the Beatles in. So cliche. You put in like the Beatles White Album, start playing the Beatles. That would go on for like 20 seconds. My friends would walk back over it, take the Beatles out, put Paul's Boutique back in, right? So now you're seeing this like tension start to rise. It's about 11:30 at night. Everyone's been partying for a while. And I remember the last time my friend Jim put the Beastie Boys in, Liam Gallagher walks over, hits eject, takes the disc, and wings it through the party and off the wall. And next thing I know, my friend Jim is now squared off with Liam Gallagher. They're going to fist fight.
Good God.
And I'm thinking to myself, we're going to get into a fight with Oasis, right? And everyone's kind of squared off, and I'm thinking to myself, there's nobody in charge. They're, you know, obviously out of their minds. They're drunk. They're having a party. My friends are all drunk, and I'm like, this is going to be a brawl between all the PAs at this MTV winter programming and Oasis. And I'm thinking in my head, like, can you imagine the phone call and how much trouble we're going to be in if we beat Oasis up at one of our parties? Long story short, cooler heads prevailed. They get pulled apart, and you know, the night ended. But to this day, I'll run into somebody that I haven't seen in, you know, 30 years, and they'll say, remember that night we almost got into a fight with Oasis?
That's fucking nuts. That's fucking nuts.
True story. And the thing is back at MTV, back in the 90s, when you worked on a show, there really wasn't a layer between you and the talent.
No.
So when we would work on remote, like the talent would just be there, and there wasn't really handlers. So you would be at the MTV Beach House, and like, you know, Biggie Smalls would be just standing next to you. You know, it was just like, they were just there. And there was another time when we were at the MTV Beach House, the first MTV Beach House in 94 in a town called Quag, Long Island, out in the middle of nowhere. It was kind of hoity-toity, fancy, kind of Hamptons. And we had this first beach house. And at the time, there were these magazines that you could buy, like these sweepstakes magazines, where you could enter like sweepstakes. So you could buy a magazine at the grocery store. And it was like people that are like addicted to, you know, entering things to win free things. And I guess they had a sweepstakes to win a trip to the MTV Beach House. So we're standing in the kitchen, and Radiohead was going to perform. And Radiohead is standing in the kitchen. There's coffee and there's bagels. And we're all standing around looking at these English guys because Radio was a brand new band. No one really knew anything about them.
Good God.
Car pulls in the driveway. We look out, and these two old ladies get out. Like, they must have been like like late 70s, early 80s. And we're all looking at each other, and we're like, who are these people? And my boss, Mike, goes, oh, I forgot. Those are the sweepstakes winners. Those two ladies, they're here to visit for the day. They're, you know, they're from like the Midwest or something. So we're all like, we're going to babysit these old ladies all day long. So long story short, they come into the kitchen, and no one really knows what to do. It's the most awkward thing. They don't even know what the beach house is. I don't think they even knew what MTV was. Radio's head standing there. We're standing there, and we're like, would you like some breakfast? So they're standing in the kitchen, and they're eating bagels and having coffee with us. One of the ladies starts to choke on her bagel, and not like a, you know, a quick choke, like a, I'm going to die.
Holy crap.
Call 911 you know, choke. So she starts to choke, and we're all kind of like confused and looking. And the bass player from, I think it was the bass player from Radiohead, literally runs over, gets behind her, and Heimlichs her, and the bagel goes flying through the kitchen. Had to call an ambulance. They went to the ER. And looking back at it now, like, Radiohead's kind of like this mythic, like one of the biggest bands in the world, like, you know, a rock and roll Hall of Fame, legendary band. And I to think back, like, in the mid-90s, that the bass player saved an old woman from choking on a bagel.
That's fucking nuts.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So the moral of this is MTV has given you some really good stories, and that's kind of the way I say that, because this podcast came out of my work and crazy stories from shows that I've been on, and they're just fun to tell. So I'm sure you have a shit ton more. Probably you can't even tell, but especially back in the day with MTV.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I could probably write a book. And the thing is everybody that was at MTV in the mid-90s, they're all still working. So everyone's still in the business, and we still keep in touch. And some of my oldest friends I met in the mid-90s at MTV, and we still talk. And to this day, we all talk about how lucky we were to be there at that time, because it was much kind of simpler. The business was simpler. But also, we were at a place where there was no TikTok, there was no, you know, YouTube. Like, it was the epicenter of youth culture, and it was just an exciting place to be. And at the same time, it wasn't corporate, and it wasn't stuffy, and it didn't operate like, you know, I had friends that were accountants and people that worked in finance. They made way more money than I did, but like, if they ever came and visited me at work, they like couldn't understand. I remember my first day of work. I graduated on a Sunday. They told me to be at work on a Wednesday, that Wednesday. And I remember they told me who to report to, and I'm not going to say his name, but they told me to meet this guy on the fourth floor who I had met the summer before when I was a driver. And I show up my first day at work, college grad. I'm ready to go. I show up 1515 Broadway. I go up to the fourth floor. On the dot, 10 a.m., I knock on the door. Come in. I open the door, and the guy is at his desk doing a gigantic bong hit.
You know, that's awesome. That's what I love about MTV. You know, not corporate. Not corporate at all.
Not. And I remember thinking, this is like a hidden camera show. Like, this is my first thing. And I walked
This is your first day.
This is my first day.
Oh, shit.
This is my first day. I was living at home with my parents. I graduated from Villanova 3 days before. I told my parents, I'm going to work. I'm all proud of myself. I'm like, recent college grad. I'm going to start my career on TV. I show up at Viacom, this big skyscraper in Times Square, and Simon & Schuster is in the building. It's Viacom, Comedy Central, MTV, VH1, and I'm like, go to this fourth floor that looked like it was like a bomb blasted. It was like the biggest dump office space you've ever seen. And my boss, my direct report, is doing a bong hit at the desk at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I walk in, and he looks at me and he goes, "You want some?"
You're like, this is what you guys do?
I was like, no. And to tell you how long ago this was, when they brought me over to my workstation, you know, I was sitting kind of like a bullpen area. I had, my desk had a typewriter and an ashtray on it.
Holy shit balls.
It was a full-on like Mad Men deal. Like, it was like, it was 1994, and we had computers, and we wrote our scripts on the computer, but you had to go and sign out a slot. So everybody on the floor, when they were ready to write their scripts, would write on this one big, huge computer. And you would go and write your scripts. And when we would write scripts about music and about bands, and when we needed information to put into the script about a band maybe we didn't know anything about, we would have to walk to the other side of the building to a gigantic file cabinet. And you would pull out the file cabinet, and every band in the world was alphabetized. And the interns would just Xerox articles from Spin Magazine and Rolling Stone. I mean, that's how long ago this
was. Isn't that a trip? That's how we, like, encyclopedia shit. Like, that's how we got our information. Clippings, like you're saying.
Yep.
I mean, that was our Google. I mean, how far we've come, man.
Yeah, it was wild, man. So, so MTV, there was a lot of stuff. I could write a book, but I saw a lot of stuff, and to this day, I still laugh at some of the things that I saw.
I do like what you said about having friends everywhere in different departments, because I was literally just talking to someone else that worked at MTV Networks, and we were talking about how cool it was. Everyone knew each other very intimately, you know, like you're friends with, you know, I worked in development for MTV too, and your friends were working in development for Spike and comedy and all this. So it was great with everyone there and so much fun. And it really showed at some of the holiday parties that we had, which were nothing compared. And this is me there like in the 2000s, early 2000s. Oh. So it was well after you. So it was still a little crazy, but I can't imagine.
Those Christmas parties, they were legendary, those parties.
Yeah.
And you know, most parties are like a start time and an end time. I swear they ended when the last person left. You would walk into this gigantic room and there'd be, you know, no expense, you know, it was like sushi bar and open bars everywhere, and you know, we're all making no money. So like, you know, we're loading up on food and we're just drinking our faces off. And then I remember they would give us free car service home.
Yep.
So it's like everyone got a ride home. And the Christmas party was a big deal because to this day, my wife is angry about it. You were only no guests. You didn't get, did not get a plus one. So it was just you. And man, they were legendary parties. Judy McGrath, the president of MTV, she actually broke her arm at one of the parties. Yeah, I didn't see it, but supposedly, I think she slipped on a piece of sushi and literally went down and broke her arm. So, like, what does that tell you, man? Like, and MTV Networks is a gigantic, you know, company. This wasn't like this little, tiny little company that no one's heard of. It was a gigantic money-making juggernaut, and the president breaks their arm at the Christmas party. And because they partied, like, you know what I mean? Like they all, Tom Freston and Judy McGrath and all those, they all, you know, Van Toffler, like all those guys, they were the top of the top on the org chart, and they partied harder than anybody.
I have my connection with them is my wife worked in HR there. And so we have a lot of good friends who used to be the head of HR there, and just in HR in general, and just knowing the stigma around HR and what people think HR is like was not what MTV's HR was like at all. I mean, they were fun, they were great, they got the work done, but they were right there with you, you know.
And to tell you, like, how wild it was there, like, HR did get involved a couple of times, you know? And when HR got involved, like, back in the 90s, you knew it was... now it's criminal, you know, criminal act, you know, put somebody behind bars. But and then, you know, MTV did change, you know, as we kind of, you know, got into the 2000s, and it really started to have massive mainstream success with shows like TRL, and then they started to bring in executives from Fox and guys that came in from other networks, where the culture at MTV was like all the higher-ups when I got there started at MTV. So it's the type of place where it's like you started there and then you work your way up, right? And then, yeah, right in the 2000s, they started to bring people from the outside. And then that's when there was a little bit of a culture clash.
That makes sense.
You know, I had friends quit because these guys were like suits, you know? So it was like, so then the culture changed a little bit. So, but... you know, for those 6 years from 94 to 2000, it was great.
So you mentioned TRL. You were part of TRL, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was. I started as the head writer. My wife was pregnant with my first child, and I was getting ready to leave on paternity leave, and they didn't want to put me, I was staff there, so they didn't want to put me on another like long-term project. So they said, go and, you know, write for TRL, because we would always come up with games and things for the guests to do.
Mm-hmm.
Much like, you know, Late Night started to do. Jimmy Fallon's kind of games. Like, if you look at Fallon's Late Night show, a lot of that, that DNA to that goes back to TRL.
Yeah.
You know, because we were always like, you know, we can't just stand there and promote their stuff. Like, the audience is going to get bored. So we would, you know, that was the place where the celebrities kind of had to sing for their supper a little bit to get their plug.
Wasn't it like the largest show, the biggest show, like, I mean, for a while? I mean,
oh yeah,
it was ginormous. Yeah. It was it. It was the show to be on.
It became so big that before TRL, celebrities, when they were promoting something, they would come to New York and they would do Letterman.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do Conan when Conan was in the city, and they would do the Today Show or Good Morning America. And then the show got so popular and tapped into a younger demo, you know, that all of the movie studios and all of the record labels were like, you got to go on TRL because that audience is hard to market to, and they got millions of eyeballs every single day. So we wound up in booking wars with the Letterman show.
Oh, wow.
Like, because there would be conflicts.
Yeah, I bet.
And someone would be only available, you know, one day at a specific time, and the Letterman show would ask them, and we would ask, and they would go with us. And then, like, we would get phone calls, and, like, we started the horse trade with, like, these gigantic shows. And we were just this little, like, you know, we started as this little pissant little, you know, basic cable show. But it blew up into a cultural, like, kind of an iconic show.
Yeah, it was ginormous. It was huge. And where was another? I was looking through on your guys' page here. There was another MTV show. Wait, Andy Milonakis?
Oh, my God. The Andy Milonakis show. So Andy Milonakis is arguably, like, the first YouTube celebrity.
I can see that.
He started making these really strange YouTube videos. Singing weird songs and kind of surrealistic things. And Jimmy Kimmel actually found him on YouTube and was mesmerized by Andy and came to MTV and pitched a show, a sketch comedy show with this guy, Andy Milonakis, who was not a professional comedian. He was just a kid making videos. And my boss at the time, Tony DeSanto.
I remember Tony. Tony D.
Really great guy. Yeah
Tony D. Tony.
Great guy. Really good sense of humor, kind of a twisted sense of humor. And Tony was having massive success with shows like Laguna Beach and kind of like these soapy reality shows. But deep down, like, Tony's a big comedy guy. He's a horror guy. So he was always looking for a show to offset, you know, the big mainstream, you know, successful shows. So he was like, let's take a flyer on this kid, Andy Milonakis. So we wound up doing a couple of seasons with Andy, and it was just so much fun because it was all sketches in a half hour, and none of the sketches had anything to do with each other. They were all self-contained, and a sketch could run anywhere from 7 seconds to 6 minutes.
Jeez.
So, and lots of celebrities making cameos, and it was a really fun show to do. And at the time, you know, this is before Jimmy Kimmel had a late night show. So Jimmy was coming from, everyone knew him from The Man Show over on Comedy Central.
Yep.
And then we did Milonakis, and then he kind of blew up and became the Jimmy Kimmel we all know now.
It's fucking crazy, man. So you've had your hand in a lot of, like, culturally important, popular shows and times and periods. I mean,
and look, and that was MTV. Like, that was one of the great things about being at MTV. I mean, you know, you worked there. It didn't pay great, but I didn't study TV or film in school. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my career. So it was a way to learn how to make TV. And it was kind of like graduate school, but it was like a paid internship kind of at the beginning, and then it kind of became graduate school that I got paid for. But I got to travel all over the world, and I got to work on these amazing shows. And, yeah, it was a really special time.
I talk about that, how cool our industry is. One step back, everyone thinks it's so glamorous. And I'm like, no, it's not glamorous. You know, you might see like a second or a minute out of, you know, however long, but it's not glamorous at all. I mean, the shit that we have to do. But with that said, the places we get to go are pretty fucking awesome. I mean, I've been around the world a couple times, as I'm sure you've many, on the company's dime. And the places you get to go and the experiences you get are just are priceless. And it's been, you know, really awesome to be able to do that and then spearhead into this podcast that I have to tell stories from all those trips or, you know, sets or just crazy shit that, that I've gone through. So it's pretty awesome that we...
And it's sad because it's not the same anymore.
No.
It's changed, you know, and I have, you know, TV and film students that reach out to me or, you know, I'll speak at a college and they'll say, they'll ask for advice. And it's just so different than the way that it was. Going back to what you said a little bit earlier, like all these people in these different departments, all these creative people, you know, with remote work, it's just so different where everybody's on a screen or on Zoom or on, you know, everything's remote. But to go to a place every day that, you know, was filled with really creative people all under one roof working and seeing them at lunch in the cafeteria or going out for drinks at night. And it just, it's never going to go back to the way that it was. And I was lucky to be there to experience
it. Having that access to be able to just walk down two doors, you know, to someone, to Tony's office and ask him something or just, you're right. It was a different time. I mean, and now it's even more so. You know, with the scope of our industry, it's changed, you know, so much to what it is. You know, I wanted to just go back to one thing you said earlier about being a driver, Tim. I did look back and I do remember, I think every good leader should know what it takes to get things done. And I think you do because I look back and you've done just about every job there is out there. So you totally understand what it is to be the van driver, to, you know, be the AP, you know, everything. And I think that makes you a better leader and more successful at what you do.
Yeah, I agree. I have a really good friend who we work together at MTV. His name is Dave George. He's the CEO of ITV America. And Dave was the same thing. He started as he went to Fordham. He was an intern, worked every job all the way up. We were on TRL together. And I joke all the time that Dave, because of his time at MTV, he's a CEO that could very easily get in the hot seat and do a live show, take over and edit and deliver a series. Because of his time there, and it was really like a factory, he was able to get this foundation that translates. Most CEOs are businessmen.
Right.
Or maybe they've worked at a very high level, but they've never pulled an all-nighter or run coffee on a set or driven a van. I think you see a lot of upper echelon executives around these days that cut their teeth at MTV
in the
2000s. Yep. And they could all edit, they could all shoot, they could all write a script, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I like that. And I think that just makes you a more well-rounded leader, as I said, because you understand what it takes to get things done. You're not, you don't have unreal expectations. I champion that.
Remember something real quick about driving the van. So, funny story. I used to pull up at the studio and I had a clipboard and I would get out and I would take attendance and I would say, Adam Curry, he'd get on. John Norris, he'd get on, you know. And John Stewart would always try to get on the van. Now, John did a show called, I think it was called You Wrote It, You Watch It.
Uh-huh.
And he was under contract with MTV, but he didn't have a show because his show had been canceled. And he would say to me, come on, man, like, let me just come out to the house. I don't have any air conditioning. My apartment sucks. And I would literally call the house and say, John Stewart's here. He wants to know if we can come out to the house. And everyone loved John. So they said, yeah, bring him out. So we'd drive out with John and John would hang out at the house and we would put him in bits. And, you know, he was just at the house, but he literally didn't want to be in the city because it's August, it's sweltering, and he had no air conditioning, and so he wanted to go hang at the house. So I spent a lot of time with John Stewart, you know, driving back and forth in this van. And I remember I was driving John and Gary Auerbach. I don't know if you know Gary Auerbach.
Sounds familiar.
He did Laguna Beach. He was a producer at MTV back in the day. And I remember John saying to me, how old are you? And I said, oh, I'm 20. And he's like, perfect. I want to pick your brain. And I slowly realized that John wanted to be a talk show host. And I looked at Gary Auerbach and Gary's like, we want to develop a show where John is going to be a talk show host, and the audience is like guys your age. And I remember thinking to myself, I like Jon Stewart a lot, but he'll never be a talk show host.
Oh, man. Oh.
Which is, you know, why I went into development and made a career out of deciding what will work and not work.
Good decisions but there, Tim. Yeah, good thing.
Fast forward a few years, maybe 6-7 years, he's doing The Daily Show. I hadn't seen him. I walked onto the set to do a shoot to promote the Video Music Awards. He was going to do a quick little bit for us. And the second he saw me, he said, oh, my God, Tim Healy ran over. He gave me a big hug. How are you? How's your sister? Remember my sister's name? How's your sister, Megan?
Dang.
How's your mom? How's your mom and dad? It was like, and then he like very, we kind of reconnected for a minute. And I said, okay, John, this is what we're going to do today. And he's like, wait a minute. He's like, are you in charge? And I said, yeah. And he looked around at the crew and he's like, this crew, they're all, this is your crew? I go, yeah, I'm actually your producer. I'm producing the segment. And it was so funny. Because he got everyone's attention on the set, and he was like, let me tell you about Tim, and proceeded to tell like 5 stories about our time in the van together.
That's so fucking
and
cool.
And it was like a really sweet, like endearing thing, because I didn't know John really that well. I spent 1.5 hours, you know, each way in the van. But for him to remember me like 5-6 years later, not only me, but my sister and my mom was really great. It made me feel really good.
Yeah, it's character right there. That's awesome. That's good to hear about him. Well, now, was he there during... Didn't you guys do, like, remote control and all those at the
house? That was before my time. That was okay. So they did remote control back in the 80s. And then we did a special using the remote control talent, which was Colin Quinn and Ken Ober and Kari Wuhr. At the first MTV Beach House, we did do something with them, but we didn't do remote control. I don't know why they haven't rebooted that show.
Fucking great show.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's like, I think it's primed to be rebooted.
That and The State? I want The State to come back.
Me too. I have the box set of The State upstairs on DVD. So I have every episode of The State.
I want to dip my balls in it.
Oh, my God. My favorite was when they had an episode. They had a sketch that the Pope was coming to this Italian restaurant. So they're in this Italian restaurant, and they're all doing horrible Italian accents, and they're all wearing, like, white suits. Mama. And they're all excited because the Pope is coming. The Pope is coming. And it's the, like, strangest, most obscure sketch. And I remember a few years ago, Ken Marino from The State on his Twitter, he posted something. I can't remember what he put. And I just wrote, the Pope is a comment. And he immediately liked it and responded to it. And I was like, yes, like nerdy state fan connection.
I'm going to have to go back and watch some more because my favorite was Barry and Lamont and the Barry Box of Pudding.
Yeah,
where they're rubbing they're just talking sweet nothings to the box of put or the pudding, you know. Don't worry about it. Shh. I mean, fucking brilliant.
And they were just like a bunch of like NYU like sketch guys. But that episode they did, it was what I found out later. It was the last sketch shot on a soundstage for that season, and they wanted to destroy the set. So they all wore white outfits because, of course, someone comes out with a gigantic plate of spaghetti and the sauce, and it goes all over. And he's like, you got a sauce all over my white suit, and the Pope is a coming. And then Michael Ian Black is the Pope, and he shows up, and he goes, hey, I'm the Pope. And then he pulls out a fire hose and just starts shooting red wine, and they just destroyed the set. And it was the funniest thing when I saw it, but then I read something online that it was the last thing that they shot, and they just wanted an excuse to destroy everything.
Are you kidding? That's fucking funny.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm going to have to go back and watch that. Oh, that's funny. Well,
they were doing live stuff last year. They did a tour. I didn't see it. But they were doing theaters where they were going back. Yeah.
I'm going to watch them. They're funny as hell.
Yeah, really, I mean, really great.
Very simple stuff. Nothing too obscure, like rubbing your ass against a big pudding. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Nothing like some pudding. Well, hey, so this isn't just an audio podcast, Tim. This is also a video podcast. on and I have a YouTube channel. It's at Go for Donnie. So I invite everyone to come check out my YouTube channel where I have Go for Donnie and our other podcast, which is Channel 2. But I also have a website, Tim. On the website, there's some stories, some photos, fun stuff about me because it's all about me, you know. And I got some swag, some Go for Donnie hoodies.
Nice, love it.
Yeah, you know, you got to have some stuff to try to pimp out, you know.
Merch, so, man. Yeah, it's all about merch, the merch.
You know, some stickers to throw on your Pelly cases, yeah, you know, and
love
shit.
It.
So, yeah. So, feel free.
I actually saw one of those stickers on set. I didn't know about your podcast. And I saw one when we were on, I think it was on your laptop. And we were on location. And I remember you were under a tent and you were on your laptop. And I saw it, Go for Donnie. And I was like, that's hilarious because – we're constantly calling Donnie on a walkie. I had no idea about the podcast. I thought you just made a sticker because, you know, you hear Go for Donnie so much. So
I mean, you think I would have did that years ago, but I didn't. And now I have these stickers for the podcast. But that's funny that you thought that, you know. But it's so great having you on. I can't thank you enough for coming on, sharing a few stories. Guys, don't forget to tune in to Switch to Channel 2 next up, where we're going to get to ask Tim some more stories to get to know him a little bit better and see what he's doing next. So, Tim, thanks again. I appreciate your time. And as my mother-in-law always says, hashtag HTFU. Harden the fuck up. Thanks,
man. Thanks for having me. Good seeing you.
Cheers, man.
Good. Bye.
Production for Donnie.
Go for Donnie.
Locations for Donnie.
Go for Donnie.
Habitat for Donnie.
Go for Donnie.
Hey Donnie, what the hell are they doing?